From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. After 2 full months of the U.S.-directed Saudi airstrikes against their country, more than 65% of the people of Yemen are without drinking water. That, according to the UK-based aid organization Oxfam, which said that at least 16 million people are going without. Press TV's Bardia Honardar has more.
The constant Saudi bombardments have raised the number of Yemenis without clean water to at least 16 million. Oxfam says this is equal to the populations of Berlin, Paris, and Rome combined together. Weeks of airstrikes and ground fighting have disrupted large parts of the water network in the Arab country. Oxfam also says Yemenis are forced to drink unsafe water, which has increased the risk of life-threatening illnesses such as cholera and diarrhea. For more on that story, we're joined by radio host and political commentator Mr. Max Egan, who's with us from Andalusia. Mr. Egan, 16 million people, according to Oxfam, do not have access to clean and drinkable water as a result of the Saudi bombardments on Yemen. Give us your thoughts on the recent numbers released by the rights organization.
Look, these numbers are astronomical. I think it's beyond a lot of most people's comprehension to really be able to conceive the sheer scale of tragedy and human rights, what we're seeing here in Yemen. It's absolutely disgraceful. We need to stop this bombardment immediately. What we're seeing here, this is unbridled terrorism being carried out against the people of Yemen by Saudi Arabia, and we need a huge uprising to stop this. We really do. This is a humanitarian tragedy of absolute epic proportions, like nothing we've seen. And it's totally contrived. It's been totally brought about by Western forces by against people who wanted a democratic government. This makes no sense at all. They wanted a democratic government where the king was not going to have, or the controlling hand was not going to have so much power in Yemen. And because they decided to stand up against the system, they just obliterated the whole country, worse than we've seen them done to any other country recently. I don't know how we're going to deal with this, and I don't know what it's going to take for people to stand up and make noise about this. It's absolutely outrageous.
Mr. Egan, Yemen's infrastructure has been totally obliterated. Women and children are being killed as a result of the attacks. And now, according to this report, water, which is one of the most basic commodities, is now a scarcity for ordinary civilians in Yemen. Are you surprised that there has still not been a formidable international push to get the Saudis to halt the airstrikes on Yemen?
I am extremely surprised, and it shows the UN up for what they really are. I mean, this is supposed to be a bastion of international law and human rights protection, and it's doing nothing to stop this at all. This needs to stop immediately. All support needs to be withdrawn from Saudi Arabia, and this needs to stop, and aid agencies need to get in there as quickly as possible. The people in Yemen are depending on it. You've got to remember, these people are trapped at the end of a peninsula. They've got an ocean on the other side of them. There's nowhere for them to go, and it's a desert region. This is absolutely outrageous, and I don't know why we're not seeing the international community standing up in complete defiance against what Saudi's doing. It's absolutely incredible. It boggles my mind. It really does. I've been watching the news there every day, and just seeing what's unfolding, it's devastating. It really is, and we need a massive push by the West to stand up and stop this immediately and get aid into these people.
Over 1.5 million EU nationals living in the UK will be barred from a promised referendum on whether or not the UK should leave the European Union. The in-or-out vote was a key campaign pledge by David Cameron, and after his party's capture of the British parliamentary election, the referendum could now take place as soon as next spring. British expatriates are also beginning to show concern, as RT's Lizzie Fallon reports.
The European Union is often blamed for flooding the UK with immigrants, taking British jobs and putting a strain on public services. The panic surrounding the immigration debate in Britain is one of the main driving forces behind the push to leave the Union. Little is spoken of the hundreds of thousands of Britons living in other member states, like in this small, picturesque town, Chantilly, north of Paris, which is dotted with tea shops and other symbols of the British presence, like this racecourse course, which has been home to jockeys and horse trainers from Britain since the 1800s. But with the Conservative win in the recent UK election, along with the promise of a referendum on leaving the European Union, expats who want to remain here in France are suddenly faced with the prospect of either having to apply for a residency to stay or French citizenship. Alison and Anna Karina have laid deep roots in France, raising families and setting up businesses close to Chantilly. If Britain chooses to say goodbye to the EU, they say many expats will say adieu to their home soil.
I hope they don't leave, and I am worried. Yeah, I'm worried. If Britain leaves, I'm worried. For my pension, for health care here, for my children's possible education in the UK, if they want to go to university there.
It's a real terrible disaster for England. I think the people who've invested here, and they've been here for a long time, just they are not going to up sticks and go back to Britain.
For the time being at least, these expats are not prepared to go as far as becoming French citizens to keep living on the continent.
I don't want to become a French citizen. I would like to carry on staying living here. I like the fact that my children are bilingual and bicultural. We have as many French friends as English friends, but I am British.
The third round of talks between the United States and Cuba, aimed at normalizing relations between the two nations, concluded in Washington. Discussions had centered on the technical aspects involved in opening embassies in the respective capitals. A Cuban Foreign Relations Ministry official, Josefina Vidal, said the talks were respectful and showed that progress was being made. For her part, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Roberta Jacobson characterized the talks as, quote, highly productive, close quote. China issued its 2015 White Paper on National Defense Tuesday, detailing its current military and security strategies. It calls for a strategy of active defense to effectively deter threats and better protect China's national interests. The document also lays out the developing trend of China's military capabilities. CCTV's Han Bin has more.
China's military build-ups and activities and its military intentions and directions are often under close watch by the world. The Chinese military is here to explain what's behind the development and what's to come.
This paper is highly strategic and comprehensive, with a focus on China's present military strategy and its orientation in the future.
The military is undergoing deep transformations under the new leadership. It's speeding up modernization with high-tech weaponry and information technology, fast integrating its land, naval, and air forces. And it has increased regular blue water missions and become more active in international security cooperation. The white paper explains the components of its active defense policy and the impact on the ever-changing role of the armed forces under a new security environment.
China's armed forces will implement the military strategic guideline of active defense in the new environment. The paper stresses far-sighted planning and management, creating favorable positions, comprehensively managing crises, and deterring and winning wars.
The white paper comes at a time of rising tensions in the South China Sea and louder criticism of China's military buildup. President Xi Jinping has called for strengthening the army and its capabilities to prepare it for a win in the event of conflict. China says its military is still defensive in nature, yet is becoming more active in protecting its interests. Leaders believe China faces complex and diverse security challenges in protecting its sovereignty, and the military must adjust to the changing situation to better protect peace and stability.
This is the ninth white paper on this subject. Unlike previous ones, which focused mainly on what the PLA has been doing, this new document is concentrating on its future development. Many say that the growing transparency of the intentions of the Chinese army may indicate both its growing willingness and confidence in taking more active role on world stage. Han Bin, CCTV, Beijing.
For more details, Han Bin spoke with Zhao Bo, a senior colonel in the People's Liberation Army, about the paper.
First, tell us, what new message does the white paper intend to send?
Well, this new defense white paper is an unprecedented Chinese effort of making its military more transparent. Because if you look back into the history of Chinese publication of this defense white paper, you would conclude that most of them are very much general description. But since the last one, they become somewhat different in that they're more focused. The last one focused on Chinese military's capabilities, while this one focuses on Chinese military's intentions. If we talk about any military, the most important thing is, first of all, your capability. The second thing is your intention. So having published such a defense white paper, it shows Chinese military it is confident, but it's not about saber-rattling or flexing up its muscle. It's a genuine intention of the Chinese government and its military to let itself be better understood by the world.
So one of the biggest changes is from the Chinese Navy. What role will it play in dealing with the current tensions in the South China Sea?
Well, in this defense white paper, the Chinese Navy actually is found in all chapters because Chinese Navy has an increasingly important role in safeguarding not only its China sovereignty and territorial integrity, but also its increasing national interest overseas. Of course, the Chinese Navy has a role in defending China's sovereignty. Therefore, the dispute in South China Sea is concerned. But we are not talking about using forces in resolving any of our disputes. As a matter of fact, since 1980, China is not using any forces against any neighboring countries. So China's rise is so far very much peaceful.
How can China avoid potential conflicts with other navies like the United States?
There are certain cases of dangerous situations, but as I said before, the Chinese military has entered into no war with anybody since 1980. The good thing is, especially since last year, the Chinese military has been very much active in engaging all the other militaries in preventing any crisis. For example, in Qingdao last year, we have agreed to sign a memorandum, which is actually called CUS, a code of conduct for unplanned encounters on the sea. And with the United States last year, we actually have concluded a notification mechanism on major military activities. And the second one is on rule of behavior between Air Force and Navy when they encounter on the sea or in the air. But the air-to-air part has to be concluded this year.
What kind of cooperation does the PLA want to forge?
We talk about China's international responsibility, actually, because the military actually would have to do two things. Number one, to safeguard your own national interests. And secondly, if possible, you have to provide international security goods to the international community. Since the Chinese military is the largest in the world, and it is already operating in the different parts of the world, therefore, the Chinese armed forces definitely have an increasingly important role in providing more security products. And actually, it is doing this. For example, in the Gulf of Aden, it has not only escorted Chinese ships, but foreign ships as well. And it did something that it actually could not envision in the beginning. For example, to provide fresh water to the Maldives and to escort the chemical weapons on the ships out of the territorial waters of Syria. And recently, in the war of Yemen, we actually have evacuated not only Chinese, but a lot of foreign nationals. So the Chinese military, since its very beginning of operating overseas, has been making great efforts to blend the two things together. One is China's national interest, another is international responsibilities. And this would spearhead the future of the Chinese military in the world.
China lodged a complaint with Washington over an incident last week that involved a U.S. surveillance plane which flew over disputed territory in the South China Sea. On Monday, Hua Chunying, a spokesperson for China's foreign ministry, termed the incident a violation of China's territorial waters and airspace.
The freedom of navigation definitely does not mean that foreign military vessels and aircraft can violate other nations' territorial waters and airspace. The U.S. is not concerned by issues in the South China Sea. It should fully respect the efforts made by China and ASEAN nations and be mindful of its words and actions. It should help to build a good atmosphere for discussions, not make the situation worse.
As we reported last week, a former top CIA official told CNN that he believed a U.S. war with China was a real possibility. Another prominent voice in the U.S. raised that concern, financier George Soros. In an article published Friday by the Russian news agency Sputnik, Soros was quoted as saying that there was a real danger that China would align itself with Russia politically and militarily, and then the threat of the Third World War would become real. Soros counseled that the U.S. should bind China to the Western-dominated global system by allowing the Chinese currency to join the International Monetary Fund's system. With more on that, we spoke with Umberto Pascali, an independent analyst based in Washington, D.C., who specializes on strategic geopolitical issues.
Soros has always been doing, he threatened a war, no?
Yeah.
Unless China doesn't find a monetary agreement with the dollar.
Right.
That's the fundamental point.
Yes.
Now, Soros has been doing this all the time. He's been said, besides doing the dirty job of the Color Revolution, he has been sent in many countries to threaten the economic elite or the financial elite. He did the same thing with euro for a long time. He was predicting, quote unquote, that the euro would collapse. It's the end of the euro. Now, there is a lot of reason why someone should deeply dislike the European Union bureaucracy, but what he was doing was part of a speculation. And there is always the same point, like now in the threat against China. He's defending the supremacy, or better at this point, the existence of the dollar system. That's the point. Now, for what concerns China, what is happening is that China doesn't really need anymore the dollar system. They have created an alternative system, and now the alternative system, monetary, financial, and economic. It's not just economic, it's also financial and monetary. It's the system of the BRICS, and especially the agreement, public or maybe less public, with Russia. So Soros is telling them, don't you dare to do anything to escape some, to escape the dollar, to escape a relation with the dollar. We can be nice. At this point, I think they are quite scared. The people is being a messenger for. And, you know, we can be nice, we can let you have this change in the International Monetary Fund that until now discriminated against China, you know, in a really imperialistic colonial way. But you cannot go your independent way. You cannot create a system alternative to us, or there will be a war. Okay? Mm. Now, this is the real message. That what I see behind this statement in public is fear. These people, Soros, and the people who send Soros, you know, the bigger shark.
Right.
Soros is the piranha, and then there are the bigger sharks. they want, for a long time, they want to have a deal with China, a deal with China at their conditions. And they try to blackmail China, to pressure China, to threaten China. you don't know how many scenarios they've prepared on China that would break up. Countryside against the cities on the coast. Rich against poor. The old Maoist tendency against the technocratic tendencies.
Right.
And every kind of scenario they could have imagined, China didn't stop, didn't go back, actually went forward. At a certain point, it's about, I believe, 2-3 years ago, a decision was taken in China. We are not going to fight them, you know, to respond blow by blow. We are going our way.
Right.
And this is the most terrible thing China could do to Wall Street and the city of London. And that's what Soros is telling them not to do. But he doesn't have any card in his hand. What do they have? Is China a war China, Russia, militarily, only militarily, have not been as strong as they are now, ever before. And you can see they call Russian expansion. Basically, Russia was totally, there was a cordon sanitaire against Russia. There was a cordon. And they couldn't even go in the China Sea. And now they begin to push back. This is called, okay, now China has this new imperial tendencies. But what can they do about it? They will use the nuclear bomb? Which kind of war they are envisioning? You know, all this concentration on Asia since Obama went on, that was one of his mission. The mission of Obama was, and Biden said it clearly at the very beginning, the danger is not Iraq. Bush was an idiot, not because he did the wars, but because he did the wrong wars. We are going to do the right wars. Who is the enemy? Who is the force that really we have to rival with? China, Russia, India, a big superpower. He said it explicitly at the presentation of the ticket in the first time Biden, Obama went public. And so, but what have they done? They tried to keep up in Afghanistan, but still they didn't do any improvement. They tried to buy up India. Instead, now they have an India that is going back to non-alignment. You know, Modi, you know, the fundamentalist, all the things they said on him. But the real point was not the fundamentalist, non-fundamentalist, Hindu, non-Hindu, was that these people, the Indians, were going toward the policy of independence, non-alignment, and with the British colonialism or the following American imperialism. Russia and China at this point are Siamese twins. Nobody can split them, and they realize that. Right. So Soros is threatening a war. It's like a child to say, you know, I will throw a tantrum.
Yeah, and the response, I mean, India is a perfect example. Last week when they had a summit meeting, India and China are closer than they have ever been. I mean, back in the 60s, they actually had a little hot war for a short while, and it's much different now.
Yeah. If you see all the foreign policy of the United States inherited from the British Empire, straight wars, we create a spike between Russia and China, and we put India on our side. You remember Condoleezza Rice? Mm. When she was probably still in the National Security Council, before became Secretary of State, she went to India and told them, we are going to make you a superpower. Because they have this profile of the Indians, you know, the British profile. They are megalomaniac, narcissistic, they think to be the center of the world. You know, the typical master profile of the servant.
Right.
The Indians totally escaped the profile now.
Mm. And I'm looking also at the response by China that's underway at the moment in South America with the U.S. Is fast-tracking the TPP. I guess they shook the votes out in the Senate, and that's going to happen. And so if that's the thrust, the parry from China is they're negotiating exactly with Peru, Colombia, you know, the Mexico, the members of the TPP.
Yes. Yes. Even all the trade agreement that the U.S. will propose at this point to Europe, to South America, to anybody, they are not considered serious, even if people will play pay lip services, they they will they will negotiate, especially because still there are in the leadership of many countries there are people that are paid agents of the Anglo-American financial interest. Mm-hmm. But still, if you look at the real world, the world of real economy, you see Russia, China, India developing healthy real economy, right, developing, and they have a lot to offer to any country. When China goes somewhere, they don't say, oh, we are Chinese, we are red communist, or I don't know, we are imperialist. No, they say, okay, what you need? Roads, your infrastructure, schools, okay, we will give you credit and we will help you. Of course, you know, China is improving continuously their technology. Until now, was not the, you know, the utmost, the very top. But that doesn't matter because they are developing. Once the United States were able to offer to their associate, their Sochi, as the Roman called the conquered people, they were ready to offer them the Marshall Plan. Right. We will let you develop. And people said, thank you very much. You know, we will say everything you want, but we want our economy, we want our future. Now they cannot offer anything. They cannot offer any, even a caricature of a Marshall Plan. Right. Instead, China, Russia, they are breaking, and this is the most important thing done, they are breaking the monopoly of credit.
Right.
Until now, the system of dollar, IMF, Federal Reserve, and World Bank, and the big Wall Street city of London banks, they had the monopoly of credit. There was nobody else.
Right.
I mean, it was, if you want to buy anything, you have to use dollars. They print the dollars, and they don't have to work. That was the assumption. Mm. Now, you have the BRICS, the new development bank of the BRICS. Then you have a special fund for a country that will be in trouble monetarily. It means if a country gets attacked by speculation, you know, like Soros did many times, did against Italy, against the country in Southeast Asia, even against England, he speculated against the pound. But if there is such thing, we have this fund that will defend you. Then the infrastructure investment banks, AIIB, that is the substitute, I mean the substitute is much better, than the World Bank or the IMF. Doesn't force you to accept any conditionalities. This bank have been all inaugurated now, at least the final phase. They have been discussing for years. The final phase is now. And Soros understand, and the masters of Soros understand, that this is the beginning of the end. So they scream.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you don't need dollars to mediate when Chinese construction projects don't require dollars. They have their own reserves, their own currency, and their own infrastructure and production capacity. It doesn't involve the United States at all. If you look at Peru, for example, just now, where China is saying to Peru, here, we're going to build you a transcontinental railroad that will make your country a major port for trade with Asia and a transshipment spot to the entire South American continent. And the United States says, here, we have more neoliberal austerity for you. It's very hard for a government, regardless of its political inclinations, to make that choice.
Yes, you are absolutely right. It's a joke. It's, you want us to starve you to death, torture you, and invade your country, or you want a real economy, a future for the next generation, prosperity and stability? Okay, difficult choice.
So, in terms of the messaging by Soros on behalf of himself and whatever members of the elite he represents, do you think that that's an empty threat, a bluster, or do you think that there's really a possibility of a war behind it?
You have to follow what's happening in reality. In reality, if you threaten a war, do you have the instruments to make a war? Mm. Then you have to see the status of the U.S. forces. You know, and also the subjective aspect. Are these people, are the people that are in the military or the people that are general and they are in charge and they have real responsibility? They are not criminal like Soros. They feel a certain sense of patriotism, responsibility toward their men, toward their country. So they have a sense of realism. Will these people endanger everything? Because they are ordered by the clique in New York that they, most of them, I believe, secretly hate. Would they accept their order, go to kill yourself, you know, in order to save our banks? And we are arriving at that point. That's where, you know, the real information becomes important.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.